thanks to Misoma for sponsoring the first series of The Making Of. Every piece of a woman's jewellery tells part of her story. Earrings she bought with her first paycheck, a pick-me-up present from her best friend after a crappy breakup, the matching bracelets they got on that wild holiday, her 18th birthday, her 30th birthday, an anniversary gift she'll never forget. From past loves to career milestones, from morning to night, we wear our treasured moments, whatever shape or size. And Misoma is here for all those moments. They're on a mission to build a more confident, creative, and collaborative world, starting a chain reaction, one link at a time. Make your moments last forever with Misoma and get an exclusive 15% by using Make15 now on Misoma.com. You're listening to The Making Of, a brand new podcast from the female lead. I'm Bea Appleby, and in this series, I'll be talking to some of my favourite women about the moments that have made them. We'll talk about the highs and the lows and the turning points that have shaped their lives. But don't worry, I promise we won't call them journeys. My guest today is the author and broadcaster Dame Mary Beard. She's one of the most original and renowned classicists, famous for making the ancient world accessible and entertaining. And she's also well known for publicly defending herself in an extremely impressive way.
You can stand up to the buggers, you know, you can look them in the eye. I think it's just very important to show that that's possible.
Mary is Professor of Classics at Newnham College, Cambridge. She's Classics Editor of the TLS. She's also an author of award-winning and best-selling history books and presenter of documentaries on BBC TV and radio. We talked all about the moments that made her, but also covered subjects like how not to be boring, cancel culture, and the treatment of older women on TV. Here we go. So, Mary Beard, welcome to The Making Of from the female lead. We're going to talk about six moments that have made you, chosen by you. Your first moment is going to the British Museum when you were 5 years old. What happened?
I grew up in Shropshire, really kind of pretty rural. When I was five, my mum, who was a school teacher, thought that I ought to go to London. And we were going to do fun things and serious things. And one of the places on the agenda was the British Museum. And I was really dead keen on seeing, obviously, every kid is, the Egyptian stuff. But it wasn't so much the mummies that caught my attention. It was the bits of Egyptian everyday life that were there. And I remember still now, because you'll see why in a minute, my mum pointing out to me at the back of a case a little bit of carbonised Egyptian cake, something like 2000 BC or something like that, 4,000 years old. And I remember, you know, she said, oh gosh, you know, isn't this amazing? You know, and I remember then thinking, blimey, you know, there is a, something as kind of trivial as cake could survive for so long. The trouble was that the British Museum's cases back then were not like they are now. They weren't child-friendly at all. So I couldn't really see into the... It was right in the back of the case. I couldn't see it. I was desperate to see it. So what my mum had to do was... And she put the bags down and she lifted me up. I kind of strained over all this other stuff. And it still was very awkward. And then a bloke went past. And he saw this was going on, a kind of bit of kerfuffle and bags on floor and wriggling child. And he came up and said, what was it I wanted to see? And so me and my mum said, oh, a bit of cake in the back. And he got his keys from his chain. He unlocked the case and he reached in and he got the cake out and showed it to me, you know, right under my very eyes. And I just remember then feeling so excited, you know, that, and I think it was partly an excitement at this little bit of Egyptian cake, but it was partly, it was somehow a real lesson in how people will open things up for you, quite literally, mm-hmm. how they'll help you, how, you know, there you are and you're just interested and you're a kid, but there are people out there who'll say, so what are you interested in? Let me show you. And it was a sort of wonderful message, really. So it really does stick in my mind.
I love that metaphor that people will open doors for you if you show enough enthusiasm. So some people get really turned on by artefacts and some people don't. For you, what does an artefact like that old piece of cake do for you?
It's not about the artefact itself, it's about the people who might have eaten it, right? Mm. You know, that, you know, artefacts are the best that we can do for kind of kind of getting close to the people in the past. I mean, I remember when I first went on an archaeological excavation, it was a very sort of unglamorous, unsexy one. I remember excavating a Roman coin, you know, and just in some ways, the thought that the last person who touched this was a Roman, you know, was kind of exciting. And I think that, I mean, people do often say, oh, all those things just piled up in, you know, museum cases, oh, it's so boring. You know, I think that, you know, not with everything, but with most things, I think if you sit down with people face to face with the stuff, it's, you know, it's really easy to make it come to life. I mean, one of the most memorable and slightly sort of sad objects I can recall is the surviving baby's cradle that came out of the site of Herculaneum, the other main town that was destroyed in the eruption of Vesuvius in 79. And it had been found with still what was obviously the remains of a kind of mattress and a tiny little baby skeleton. And, you know, just sitting there and being allowed to get close to it, occasionally even touch it. You know, you think the last person really before us that did this was the mum or the nurse who rocked that little baby that didn't survive in its cradle. Now, I kind of defy anybody not to be a bit moved by that.
Yeah, that is mind-blowing, isn't it? It's incredible. So then after that, you went to Cambridge, to Newnham College, who, by the way, rejected me, but we won't go into that. So you said before that university was the first time you really felt gender inequality or saw it properly. How did that come about?
Well, yeah, I suppose you could say I've been pretty blind before, but I went to an all-girls school and my mum and dad were, you know, absolutely committed that I should do anything I wanted to do, you know, whatever my gender. I was very interested in, you know, what we then used to call, God, this dates you, doesn't it, women's lib, right? You know, and I read Germaine Greene and all that kind of stuff. Mm. But I sort of thought, I remember in a way, I kind of thought it was all a bit theoretical. You know, I agreed with it. I was very sort of, you know, kind of feisty about that, but it was about books. Women's liberation was something you read about, and you know, I'd not noticed, and I probably, you know, I'm sure I was blind, I'd not noticed any kind of active discrimination against me. Now, when I got to Cambridge, for a start, there was only 12% of the students were female and the rest were men. And so, having been at an all-girls school, I then went into something that was really minority female. I was at a women's college and that made it feel, you know, I had female kind of female society to me. But you did start to realise, you couldn't avoid it, that, you know, there were some of those guys who got up and lectured who, you know, they exuded the idea they didn't think you were really serious. Right. You know? And but most of all, vividly, I remember it was a friend of mine, and it's a guy I'm still friends with. And he came into my room and he picked up an essay that I'd done and had marked, which was on the floor because it was very messy. And at the bottom of this essay, my supervisor had written something like, you know, this is very good, this we get a first. And I remember him saying to me, what, you get a first? And I thought, and he's still a dear friend. Yeah. I thought, The only reason you're saying that is because I'm female. There's no other reason. There can be no other reason whatsoever. And, you know, so slowly the penny dropped that there were people who didn't take you as seriously because you were female, that didn't rate you so highly. And I found that my mates had plenty of similar stories.
And how did that affect your view of your opportunities in life?
And I think the honest answer is not much, really, right. Because I had, you know, I was at a women's college, and, you know, what a women's college does is it tries to inoculate you against that.
Right.
You know, it recognises it, it treats it slightly silly, you know, how could these people think that? Mm. But it puts a bit of iron in the soul. And so although I saw it, if anything, I think it would have increased my desire to do what I wanted to do, you know, damn you, really.
Okay, so you graduated from Cambridge, and this leads us on to moment number two, which is getting your first job and wearing blue stockings for the interview. What was the job?
It's one of those kind of really, really lucky breaks, you know, and I'd be the first to admit I have been extremely lucky. You know, I've been pushy, I've been determined, I'm quite smart, but I've also been very lucky, you know. And I was in my second year of my PhD, and there was a job at King's College London advertised. And it was in Latin literature. I didn't really work in Latin literature. I worked in Roman history. And I thought, oh, well, I'll give it a go. I'll apply. Why not? You know, nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of confidence of youth, isn't it? And I was extremely surprised to get an interview. You know, I thought, I wonder how many women I'll be interviewing for this job. You know, by now I was pretty attuned to that. And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'm going to get this dress. I wear a dress. That's what you wear for an interview. But I'm going to wear blue tights because I know that they'll be saying to each other when I go in the room, this one's a bit of a blue stocking, right? And I want to show you that I already know that's what you're going to say. I've beaten you to it, right? Blue tights, right? And it gave me a tremendous feeling of confidence because I thought, whatever they think about me, they're going to have to reckon that I got there first.
Love it.
And I got the job, right? And now I tend, when my female students go for their job interviews, I always say, wear blue tights.
That's such a good story. I love it. And this first job, apart from the blue tights aspect, and it being your first job, how did it shape you?
Well, I got out of Cambridge. You know, I mean, Cambridge had been great. And, you know, I eventually came back here, but... yeah, it was terribly exciting going to London. It was terribly exciting being part of a kind of very different sort of university. My colleagues really looked out for me. And the women colleagues, we often had big discussions about the role of women in the academy. Right. And that was the first time, you know, I'd had it a student before. But it wasn't really until I got my first job that I realised that this wasn't a student problem. Right. There were things in here about women's voices, about who gets to speak, who gets promotion. One of the things that we noticed, and again, you'd have to have been very dumb not to, was that when we went to seminars, the women didn't speak. Mm. By and large, the women were there in... They were a minority, but they were a significant minority. But really, it was blokes around the table saying, but come on, Fergus, I don't really... I mean, you know, it was very sort of male talk. And we used to spend hours, partly successfully and partly, I have to say, dreadfully unsuccessfully, you know, plotting about how to solve this, because it wasn't that we didn't have anything to say. We had loads to say. It's just we could never quite get it in, you know? You know? And I remember, and I think this rings true with a lot of women, what we noticed was that when a woman did dare to speak in this formal but informal setting, Blokes would talk, then a woman would say, oh, I wanted to say this. Then there'd be a silence after she'd made her point. And then some guy would come in and say, what I was trying to say was, you know, and it was as if she'd never spoken. And she felt terrible because she thought, somehow I didn't get into the conversation. So we had all kinds of, as I say, partly successful strategies whereby we'd say, we'd never let a woman have a contribution that was followed by silence. We'd always say, that's a good point, or I was thinking that too, or something. So there was a great feeling of solidarity to it. And it's a feeling of solidarity that I've kept up, for 40 years.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. I just want to take a minute to tell you a bit more about The Female Lead. We're a charity founded by Edwina Dunn, exploring the factors that limit women's success and fulfillment. By listening to women and understanding them through research and data, we aim to influence businesses and government to drive real change. We're passionate about telling women's stories, and that's what this podcast is all about. So please do rate and subscribe at the end. It will really help us to continue our work and tell more women's stories. So talking about your development, let's go on to moment three, which is being told that you were boring or that an article you'd written was boring. Who said that to you, Mary?
This is when I was at this job at King's College London. I stayed there for 4 years. It was immensely, I really enjoyed it. When I was there, I finished my thesis and I started to think, I never actually published my whole PhD thesis in a way that would be terribly shaming now, but it sort of wasn't so bad. Mm. But I was publishing some articles, and as well as having a lot of female solidarity, I was great friends with a man who was an ancient historian, but combined that with being a sociologist, and he was professor of sociology at Brunel, and we... and his name was Keith Hopkins. And he was he was much older than me, but he was still an enfant terrible. And he wanted to shake up the subject, really. He wanted to make ancient history different, not so stuffy, etc. You know, the kind of thing. Keith was very helpful to me, and he was very tough. And he's the kind of guy now who would be sort of disciplined at university because he spoke his mind. He was outrageous. He didn't mince his words. You know, he didn't believe in making you feel good. You know, he would tell you what, he would tell you what he meant. And I'd written this article. I can't now remember too much what it was about. And I'd agreed that I would show it to him and he would comment on it. And I'd given it to him a few days before. We went to have one of our lunches at Pizza Express. And, after we'd had a good bit of wine, I remember saying, what about the article? And he said, look, you know, I'm sure you're right, you know, but he said, it's boring. It's just boring, Mary. And that was a kind of real eye-opener moment, because actually I sort of knew it was too, you know. And I needed someone not just to pat me on the back. I needed someone to say, it's boring. And then he said, you could interest me. If you tried, you could write and you could interest me and you would really make an impact. But you've got to start by saying what is interesting about this, not be so damn anal about it. You know, and then he said, and this would certainly be not allowed now, he said, you've got to seduce me, right? And he meant with words. That would be now, you know, even as a metaphor, it would now not be allowed. But he was right, you know, I think... What he was saying to me was that what I'd done is I had written to show myself that I was right. I hadn't written to persuade anybody else. I hadn't written to say, hey, look, this is interesting. Come with me. I hadn't thought of the audience. I just, it was Beard talking to herself. And I think a lot of academic articles are people talking to themselves. They may be very useful, but they're not seductive. You know, and there is something about seductive prose, or we could put it less offensively, we could say persuasive.
And also entertaining in some way.
How do you persuade? Make it fun, you know? You know, there is no need to be boring and to associate being learned with being boring is one of the things that old-fashioned academe has rather bequeathed to us.
And I can see exactly how this shaped you, because you are absolutely not boring, you're entertaining, and this is what you've given classics. That's part of your success, right? That you've made it interesting for everyone.
Yes, and you're still, you can still be quite difficult, you know, but, and I think a lot of people do, are suspicious, a lot of, not my colleagues, but there would be, you know, traditional people in the academy who think that if it's sparky and fun and if it makes people laugh, it must be superficial. Well, I think that's not true. And I think Hopkins taught me that that was not true.
So your moment number four is starting work on the Times Literary Supplement.
In a way, kind of carries on the story, because this is when I kind of started to learn that you could write for a yet wider audience, really. And I'd been very anxious, I think, to try my hand at this. And I remember when I first got asked to do a review for the TLS Times Literary Supplement, I remember being very excited. I remember actually showing it to Hopkins before I sent it off. Right. Because I kind of thought, look, if you're going to be a classicist and, you know, work on, you know, people 2,000 years dead, you want somehow to share that with people who are not only the other people who are working on them. You know, right. You want this to be part of the world. Mm. And so I started to do quite a lot of reviewing for the TLS. And, you know, I enjoyed it. And I particularly enjoyed it when I had very young kids, because, I mean, I think that when you have very young kids, one thing you discover is that in some ways you do have quite a lot of time, but you have no time in big blocks. Mm. You know, you have lots of quarter of an hours.
Right? Yes, so true. No immersion in anything.
Yes.
Your own.
The idea of doing even an article where you are sustaining a coherent argument is impossible, because your time is so broken up. You can, however, do reviews. You know, and you're going to get to write 800, 1,000 words at the end of it. You can read the book on the go. And I found that a kind of great way, and I did a lot of it, for keeping in without doing enormous amounts of big, big stuff. And then when the classics editor moved on, the editor asked me if I would come and edit the classics reviews and commission the classics reviews, edit them when they came in. I said yes. But it taught me about how publishing work from a different angle, to be working. Okay, the TLS is a, you know, pretty upmarket literary paper, but it's still a paper. You know, you still have to get the words on the page each week. Was learning on the job. It was editing it, you know, helping other people find their voice, really. Mm.
And this was really the stepping stone into your TV work.
It was a stepping stone, you know, indirectly into telly. I mean, I started to think that I wanted to write high quality books about the ancient world that were not written for specialists, but did not dumb down. You know, that it told the same story, it raised the same issues, it just didn't assume that people had done a kind of classics degree.
Yeah.
You know, I was writing for what was kind of tactfully called the intelligent ignorant. You know, they didn't know about the ancient world, but they weren't stupid, right?
And what was your motivation to go down that route rather than, you know, stay in the slightly more insular academic world?
Well, a bit of me always did stay and always has stayed there. So it's not that I've jacked it in entirely, and it's very happy to have a bit of a bifocality here. Mm. I think it was basically a bit of old-fashioned socialism, really. Right. I mean, you know, I come from a generation that people now find very distant, but, you know, I've been educated at university at the taxpayer's expense. I was in a public job, right? My students at that point still had grants. You know, it was coming to the very end.
Yeah.
probably had by the point that I did it. But, you know, I still thought that there was a sort of obligation on the part of the beneficiary of the state to pay back a bit. Now, I think there's different ways of doing that, you know, and I think that I don't think that for a minute that, you know, everybody should be forced to write popular books and go on telly. There's all kinds of ways of paying back what you've got. But for me, that seemed fun, and I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the kind of writing that it involved. And I started to work with a publisher that I still write for, Profile Books. So I used to talk to this guy, Peter Carson, a lot about how to do it. And when he said, you know what, I think you'd be really good at doing, you were to write a book on Pompeii. And I said, oh, God, I don't think I know enough about Pompeii to write. And he said, look, you teach Pompeii, you know. Yeah. You can go back to Pompeii. You can, you know, if you're telling me you don't know enough, you know, plausibly, after doing some work, to write a book on Pompeii, which really is arresting for people who are going to, not necessarily to want the detail of every archaeological bit of, you know, fine-tuning, but say, what was Roman life like here? You must be the person to do it. And so I kind of, I said, oh, okay, you know, okay. I trusted him and I did it. And in some ways for me, that was kind of the breakthrough, because it won a big history prize here. And then the controller of BBC Two at that stage was a woman, Janice Hadlow. Mm. Read it on holiday, just as I kind of intended it to be read.
Right.
And at the time, she was looking for more what she called real historians to present history programme. And she also wanted to get some more women. And she also wanted to get some more senior women. You know, she was very well aware that, you know, the middle-aged and older men had a role on telly. An authoritative role in presenting and delivering, but you didn't see women doing that. And this, of course, is coming on to my fifth.
Yes, so the fifth moment is getting your first TV show.
And I went to see her, and there was people from production company. And first of all, I said, I don't want to do this. I really don't want to do this. I didn't, because I thought it was going to be terribly time-consuming, and I was right, of course. You know, I thought that everybody's, you know, telly is, you know, hours and hours and hours and hours of hanging around while directors, well, either wait for the planes to go over or photograph birds, and you're just sitting. Yeah. She was very good, actually. She said, look, and this was true, I know that you've complained that middle-aged and older men have a role on telly in a way that middle-aged and older women don't. I am now offering you that role. You're not going to be so hypocritical that you turn me down. And that was, you know, of course she was right. I do remember presciently saying, I don't think A.A. Gill will like it, I said.
Well, I was going to ask you about A.A. Gill and his criticism of you. So knowing that you weren't the age of most women on TV at that point, did you worry about opening yourself up to criticism?
No, not really. You know, I worried about getting it wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, what do I worry about? I mean, you know, if somebody says, oh, can't you do your hair? I don't worry about that. You know, if somebody says, I don't think you got the dates of Pompey the Great right. Oh, I feel terrible.
Right. And when A.A. Gill, and for anyone who doesn't know, he was a famous Sunday Times TV critic at the time, who's no longer with us. But he said something very rude about your appearance.
Rude is putting it mildly.
How did that make you feel?
Well, it was very odd, actually, because it was both after the first television programme I did, and then again, having got into it after the second. Mm. And for anybody who doesn't know, he did say things like, oh, my goodness me, she comes into our living rooms. You'd have thought she would make an effort to make herself look presentable. Look at those teeth. Look at that hair. She ought to be on the Undateables, not on...
Oh, yes, that was it.
On the Undateables. Well, I think the first onslaught I saw of him was when I'd been lecturing in America, and I got the online Sunday Times as I was coming back, and I read this. And, you know, when you do see somebody saying that about you, I mean, your first reaction is you know, you do feel kind of, you know, your breath is taken
winded.
Away.
Yeah.
You feel winded. You feel winded. But I also thought, look, there all, might be all kinds of reasons for not liking what I do, and we can talk about this, but this is stupid. You know, as one of my friends from the television program said, one thing you always do is brush your hair. It's just your hair's like that, you know. Before every shot, you brush your hair. And I decided I was going to fight back a bit. And in fighting back, I got some allies in quite strange places. So I came back and I did a very quick article for the Daily Mail. You know, and I thought, look, I'm not going to write about this for The Guardian. You know, everybody who reads The Guardian is going to agree with
agree.
Me. You know, they're not going to say, oh, isn't that terrible? I ought to take this to an a place where people might not agree. So I did this article for the Mail. And what was really interesting was it was on the print paper and it was online. And I thought, I'm going to look at the comments under the line online. And I rather braced myself. You know, because I thought, and you know, there were a few who agreed with Gil, but the vast majority were shocked by what he'd said. And actually I thought, look, the demographic of the Mail is, there's an awful lot of women my age who read the Mail. And they saw that as an attack on them as much as on me.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I said something like, look, what do you think, I was then 55, I think, what do you think a 55-year-old woman looks like? You know, unless she's pretending not to be, what does she look like? She looks like what you see. She looks like me. And I think that was very cheering for a lot of people who, in all kinds of ways, politically and all the rest, would be nowhere, you know, nowhere near on my side. But actually saw that that in some ways, they were there with me because he was attacking them really too.
Yes, and I remember that for a few years, women just loved how you were standing up to that kind of stuff. You know, you were kick-ass Mary Beard all the time. And it was that you didn't ignore it because, you know, it might be embarrassing. You took those people on, like you did with the trolls. Why did you choose to take that approach rather than the other way, which is to ignore them and not give them oxygen?
Because it didn't feel right for me, I think. And I think that to start with, particularly with the trolls, not with Gil, you know, I did think, oh, I have to follow the advice here. You know, you don't reply, you block them. But somehow I thought, you know, this is shutting me up. You know, this is like saying there are bullies in the playground, so all the decent, upstanding young pupils have got to get out of it. You know, it's them that's the matter, not me. And what they are doing, or what I am doing to myself, if I don't reply, is I'm silencing myself. You know, I'm taking my voice away. Now, I would never preach to anybody about how you deal with internet trolls. You have to find, you know, your own way. And if blocking them and ignoring them works for you, then, you know, I'm not going to disavow that. But for me, it didn't. It made me feel frustrated. I thought if somebody said stuff like that to me in the pub, I'd say, look, I'm sorry, I don't think that's fair. You know.
Yeah. Well, you received some of the most hideous and misogynistic, horrible abuse from Twitter trolls, but you responded to them with such compassion. And actually, in some cases, you made friends with them. What happened there?
Well, there was one case in particular where, you know, a silly young boy I think he was on holiday and he probably was disinhibited by whatever, alcohol or whatever. And I'd been on, ironically, I'd been on the radio talking to Jeremy Vine about Twitter trolls, right? And he tweeted something very stupid, like, you know, I bet her vagina smells like cabbage, or, you know, something, you know, just,
what? I mean,
you think, oh, what, you know, grow up. And I wrote back and I said, look, I think, why don't you just take it down? And I just take it down. Nothing happened. And there was a bit of debate. And then somebody tweeted, I know his mum, she'll make him take it down. And it did go down. What there was a kind of sad ending though, and but there's been ultimately a happy one. The Daily Mail, you know, I've just been being quite nice about the Daily Mail. Here they decided they would go and find him, and they kind of pilloried him, etc., etc. And what this guy did, and I thought it was sensible, was, you know, he wrote to me and apologised and said, look, can I come and apologise in person? We have lunch in Cambridge. I'll come and apologise. You know, if somebody says that to you, you do it, you know. Yeah. That's, you know, it was a really, really stupid and quite nasty thing to do in the first place, but it was a pretty brave response. You know, he didn't know how I would react. And so he came, we had lunch, and we, you know, for a few years we were in contact. And in the end, because particularly from the Daily Mail stuff, if you Googled his name, you got all this. There was one case where he had a job offer withdrawn.
No.
Because of what, you know, and in the end, I started writing for him. Because I thought, it's only me that can say, look, he did something very stupid, but he's apologised, and I've accepted the apology. Matter closed. No one else can say that. And he's got a job now. I think he's doing fine.
That's very, very generous and forgiving of you. But what do you think is actually going on with those trolls? What's going on in their minds when they do something like that?
I think that some of them out there must be really nasty. I think one assumes, I think it's probably a minority, but I don't know how big a minority. I think more of them are like this guy, and they're young, foolish, you know, they've been living in a world in which that sort of misogyny has kind of been okay. And they've had a bit too much to drink, and, you know, ultimately they regret it. I think others are sad. I suppose I've stopped seeing it as being about me in that kind of personal way. And, you know, and I'd like to know a bit more about why male sadness seems to so often come out in the form of misogyny. I mean, that's, you know, there's a difficulty there. There is a difficulty.
Definitely. Definitely. And I feel like we're seeing a lot of that abuse towards older women on Twitter at the moment. There's like a culture war, but also an age war. And even from other women as well, from younger women. You've never shied away from speaking out about what you think. Do you now, in this kind of cancel culture that we're living in, do you worry that you might experience shaming and cancelling that's happened to some older women recently?
Yes, I mean, I think you do, but I think that, I mean, I've said things on Twitter that have been misunderstood. And part of the reason they've been misunderstood is I probably didn't put them very well. And now I think if a lot of people misunderstand you, you might think that maybe you didn't make your point clearly enough. Mm-hmm. And I'm totally prepared to accept that. You know, that's but I don't regret anything that I thought I was saying, even if it didn't come over like that. You know, I've shifted my views, but not significantly on some things. But you know, you don't stay thinking exactly the same all the time.
You're still very active on Twitter and you have a huge following. Do you think it's just a sewer, or can it be a force for good as well?
It can be a force for good. But I think that what you see, for example, is that there are quite a lot of young women who see you standing up to these people. They might not tweet at you. They might not come in and join in the argument, but they see that it is possible to face up to this and not, you know, and not to be oppressed by it. And I think that alone does does some good.
And I think also what lots of women really loved about you taking that position and standing up for yourself was that you were in your 50s and older, and you don't see that many women of your age doing that, because you're supposed to disappear.
Yeah.
Yes, you're supposed to disappear. And yeah. And you know, again, this is where I've been very lucky. Thank heavens I didn't do any telly till I was in my mid-50s. You know, and I rather feel sorry for people who do it when they're young, because, you know, in the end, telly gets fed up with you. Mm. And, you know, it'll get fed up with me. But at least I will have had a nice innings towards the end of my career. And that's fine. But it's also, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages about getting old. You know, and I'm extremely happy to share, you know, the advantages. I mean, when you do have a thicker skin, I mean, if someone like A.A. Gill had said, you know, she ought to be on the Undateables when I was 25, I probably wouldn't have come out of the house for a week. Mm. You know, yeah. Even though I was, even at that stage, pretty kind of confident, you right. know, confident to that degree, I don't know. Mm. And so that you, if you've been reasonably successful, and I think that's a big if, you know, I don't think women my age who are now facing an impoverished retirement have the confidence I'm lucky to have. But, if, you know, you can stand up to the buggers, you know, you can look them in the eye. And I think it's just very important to show that that's possible, and also to show, I mean, it's funny that lockdown has really helped me tremendously, because, you know, quite a lot of women said, oh god, I wouldn't do that. I, you know, don't you want to color your hair, you know, don't you want to color your hair? And now look,
everybody's coming. Yeah, you're not worrying about when you're going to get to them, get your roots done.
No, you see, so I think I've come out ahead. But, you know, it's just, you know, it is about time people thought that, you know, that older people are people too, you know, and you don't, just because you look old on the outside, it doesn't mean you're kind of a Darby and Joan on the inside.
I think having a go at older women is really the final frontier for political correctness sometimes. Because I've seen a lot of women who would call themselves feminists praising A.A. Gill, for example, and saying how much they loved his work. And he said a lot of dodgy things about women, but his legacy hasn't been cancelled because no one cares about that kind of sexism, especially towards older women.
You know, I feel that a bit, but with Jermaine.
Yeah, Jermaine Greer.
You know, that she said some really colossally stupid things recently. Yeah. When I kind of looked hard at what she'd said, they weren't quite as stupid as they were written up to be. I did a review about some of her recent stuff, and I went back to the original, and it was very selective quotation. But still, there were still some stupid things there. And, you know, this is a bit like, you know, Gladstone, or, you know, the flawed heroes of the past. You know, you're not, I'm afraid, you know, you know, as I said, I read Jermaine Greer when I still thought feminism was a theoretical issue. And it made a real difference to me.
And me too.
I'm kind of, you know, I can see that she's not always right. I don't want her to be always right. That's not the deal. But somehow to treat her as the way she gets treated, I think is... Well, I just think it's sad, really.
I agree, because she's being erased, and that hasn't happened to a whole load of problematic polemicist men.
No, that's right.
And it is pure misogyny.
That's exactly.
And in her book, The Whole Woman, she talks about the disappearance of older women, and in a way, it's like she's predicted her own erasure, and it's really sad.
Yeah, and. You know, she's got her faults, for crying out loud, she's got her faults. But, you know, if you start to look at a career and you say, would I like to have had the kind of impact on the world that Jermaine had?
Yeah.
You know, and you're not going to get, you know, imaginative, interesting, you know, groundbreaking, it's horrible cliche, people who are going to be all good, you know.
Yeah.
There's just, and you have to find a way of deploring what you disagree with without deploring them.
Yes, I agree. I agree. So let's move on to moment six, which is looking forward to retirement. Would you really retire?
No, like what I will do is I will give up my university job at the age we all have to, at 67. Right. Because in the University of Cambridge, I am pleased to say we have an agreed retirement age. Right. Where you don't go on. And I know this is where I kind of part company with other geriatrics. I see people say, oh, it's not fair that I have to retire. Well, actually, I think I am really pleased in 2 years' time, you know, barring kind of some very, very special circumstances, I'm going to retire. And I think that's good. I don't have to make a decision. It's made for me. And actually, you know, you do need young people coming in the bottom. One of the consequences of old people staying in the top is that young people don't come in the bottom. And, you know, I've done my bit. I don't feel proud. I don't feel unproud. I feel quite happy with what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it would take more than a few Twitter storms to make me feel unhappy with the contribution that I've made. But it's time for me to roll over. You know, you do your bit and then you go.
Well, I hope that you never really go and that you stay on our TV screens and on Twitter standing up to trolls until you are 150 years old.
Thank you very much, Bea. Thank you very much. I think that's very, very unlikely. I'm not anticipating living till I'm 150.
One final question before you go, and I'm asking all our guests about this, which is a moment that makes you feel truly happy, that when you think back, it was a moment of pure joy and happiness. What would that be?
It would go against everything I've been saying to imagine there's a pure and happy moment.
True.
I think that, and I'm sure I didn't quite see this at the time, though in retrospect it does, we used to my husband's also an academic, and he has a Greek student who has a house in Crete. And when the kids were young, we used to take them to what was then, it no longer is, an undeveloped beach house near Chania in Crete. You know, and I think, you know, sitting there, sitting in the sand, you know, keeping, you know, with a glass of, you know, not hugely wonderful Cretan wine in your hand. Watching the kids not drown in the sea. That was pretty nice.
That is lovely. It's so interesting that most people I've asked about this have said something about being with their families.
Yeah, well, it's the old story, isn't it? You know, whoever died wishing they'd spent more time at the office.
Yeah, it's true.
And that's the end. I hope you had a good time. Thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed this, please do rate and subscribe. We'll be back next week with another brilliant woman's story. This podcast was edited by Lauren Lind, and it was all brought to you by The Female Lead. If you want to know more about The Female Lead, please check out our website at thefemalelead.com, or our Instagram, or our Twitter, or Facebook, or TikTok, or LinkedIn, you name it, we're there for you. See you next time.